real time. So if a question with a closing date 6 months in the future opened, a forecaster could make her initial judgment, say a 60% chance the event will happen by the six-month deadline, then read something in the news the next day that convinces her to move her forecast to 75%. For scoring purposes, those will later be counted as separate forecasts. If a week passes without her making any changes to the forecast, her forecast stays at 75% for those 7 days. She may then spot some new information that convinces her to lower her forecast to 70%, which is where the forecast will stay until she changes it again. The process goes on like this until 6 months pass and the question closes. At this point, all of her forecasts are rolled into the calculation that produces the final Brier score for this one question. And that's just one question. Over 4 years, nearly 500 questions about international affairs were asked of thousands of GJP's forecasters, generating well over 1 million judgments about the future. But even at the individual level, the numbers quickly added up. In year one alone, Doug Lorch made roughly 1,000 separate forecasts. Doug's accuracy was as impressive as his volume. At the end of the first year, Doug's overall Brier score was 0.22, putting him in fifth spot among 2,800 competitors in the Good Judgment Project. Remember that the Brier score measures the gap between forecasts and reality, where 2.0 is the result if your forecasts are the perfect opposite of reality, 0.5 is what you get by random guessing, and 0 is the center of the bullseye. So 0.22 is prima facie impressive, given the difficulty of the questions. Consider this one, which was asked on January 9, 2011. Will Italy restructure or default on its debt by 31st January 2011? We now know the correct answer is no. To get a 0.22, Doug's average judgment across the 11-month duration of the question had to be no at roughly 68% confidence. Not bad given the wave of financial panics rocking the Eurozone during this period. And Doug had to be that accurate, on average, on all the questions. In year two, Doug joined a super forecaster team and did even better, with a final Brier score of 0.14, making him the best forecaster of the 2,800 GJP volunteers. He also beat by 40% a prediction market, in which traders bought and sold futures contracts on the outcomes of the same questions. He was the only person to beat the extremizing algorithm. And Doug not only beat the control group's wisdom of the crowd, he surpassed it by more than 60%, meaning that he single-handedly exceeded the fourth-year performance target that IARPA set for multi-million-dollar research programs that were free to use every trick in the forecasting textbook for improving accuracy. By any mortal standard, Doug Lorch did astonishingly well. The only way to make Doug Lorch look unimpressive would be to compare him to godlike omniscience, a Brier score of 0, which would be like belittling Tiger Woods in his prime for failing to hit holes in one. That made Doug Lorch a threat. This is a man with no applicable experience or education, and no access to classified information. The only payment he received was the $250 Amazon gift certificate that all volunteers got at the end of each season. Doug Lorch was simply a retiree who, rather than collect stamps or play golf or build model airplanes, made forecasts. And he was so good at it that there wasn't a lot of room for an experienced intelligence analyst with a salary, a security clearance, and a desk in CIA headquarters to do better. Someone might ask why the United States spends billions of dollars every year on geopolitical forecasting, when it could give Doug a gift certificate and let him do it. Of course, if Doug Lorch were a uniquely gifted oracle, he would pose little threat to the status quo. There is only so much forecasting one man can do. But Doug isn't unique. We have already met Bill Flack, the retired Department of Agriculture employee from Nebraska. There were 58 others among the 2,800 volunteers who scored at the top of the charts in year one. They were our first class of super forecasters. At the end of year one, their collective Brier score was 0.25, compared with 0.37 for all of the other forecasters. And that gap grew in later years, so that by the end of the four-year tournament, Super Forecasters had outperformed regulars by over 60%. Another gauge of how good Super Forecasters were is how much further they could see into the future. Across all 4 years of the tournament, Super Forecasters, looking out 300 days, were more accurate than regular forecasters looking out 100 days. In other words, regular forecasters needed to triple their foresight to see as far as super forecasters. How much do performance differentials of these magnitudes matter? Let's arbitrarily say that the Brier score of the average regular forecaster is equivalent to 20/100 vision. An optometrist gives that forecaster glasses that improve his eyesight to 20/40. That's a 60% improvement. How much does it matter? 20/40 is not even close to hawk-eyed vision. But look at the Sneller charts on page 95. The change from 20/100 to 20/40 results in a decent grasp of letters on rows 2 through 5, and a much improved ability to catch baseballs, recognize friends on the street, read the fine print in contracts, and avoid head-on collisions. Cumulatively, that's life-changing. Now remember that these super forecasters are amateurs forecasting global events in their spare time, with whatever information they can dig up. Yet they have somehow managed to set the performance bar so high that even the professionals have struggled to get over it, let alone clear it with enough room to justify their offices, salaries, and pensions. Of course, it would be wonderful to have a direct comparison between super forecasters and intelligence analysts, but such a thing would be closely guarded. However, in November 2013, the Washington Post editor, David Ignatius, reported that a participant in the project had told him that the super forecasters performed about 30% better than the average for intelligence community analysts who could read intercepts and other secret data. IARPA knew this could happen when it bankrolled the tournament, which is why a decision like this is so unusual. Testing may obviously be in the interest of an organization, but organizations consist of people who have interests of their own, most notably preserving and enhancing a comfortable status quo. Just as famous, well-remunerated pundits are loath to put their reputations at risk by having their accuracy publicly tested, so too are the power players inside organizations unlikely to try forecasting tournaments if it means putting their own judgment to the test. Bob in the CEO suite does not want to hear, much less let others hear, that Dave in the mailroom is better at forecasting the company's business trends than he is. And yet, IARPA did just that. It put the intelligence community's mission ahead of the interests of the people inside the intelligence community, at least ahead of those insiders who didn't want to rock the bureaucratic boat. Resisting gravity, but for how long? The purpose of laying out an argument, as I have done here, is to convince the reader, but I hope you're not convinced about these super forecasters, yet. Imagine that I asked each of my 2,800 volunteers to predict whether a coin I'm about to toss will land heads or tails. They do. I then flip the coin and record who got it right. I repeat this procedure 104 times, the number of forecasts made in the first year of the tournament. The results would look like a classic bell curve. The great majority of my forecasters will have accurately predicted the coin toss about 50% of the time, and they can be found in the middle of the curve. But a few will get quite different results. Some will mostly be wrong, far left of the curve, others mostly right, far right of the curve. What do these extreme results tell us about the skill of the people who got them? Unless you believe in ESP, the answer is nothing. There is no skill involved. Someone who correctly calls a coin toss isn't demonstrating coin-flipping forecasting ability, whether he does it one time or 100. It's all luck. Of course, it takes a lot of luck to correctly call 70% of 104 coin tosses, and if you have only one person making calls, it's extremely unlikely. But if you have 2,800 coin toss callers, the unlikely becomes quite likely. This is not complicated stuff, but it's easy to misinterpret randomness. We don't have an intuitive feel for it. Randomness is invisible from the tip of your nose perspective. We can only see it if we step outside ourselves. The psychologist Ellen Langer has shown how poorly we grasp randomness in a series of experiments. In one, she asked Yale students to watch someone flip a coin 30 times and predict whether it would come up heads or tails. The students could not see the actual flipping, but they were told the results of each toss. The results, however, were rigged. All students got a total of 15 right and 15 wrong. But some students got a string of hits early, while others started with a string of misses. Langer then asked the students how well they thought they would do if the experiment were repeated. Students who started off with a string of hits had a higher opinion of their skill and thought they would shine again. Langer called this the illusion of control, but it is also an illusion of prediction. And think about the context. These are students at an elite university who know their intelligence is being tested with an activity that is the very symbol of randomness. As Langer wrote, you would expect them to be super rational. Yet the first pattern they encountered fooled them into sincerely believing that they could predict entirely random outcomes. Outside Yale labs, delusions of this sort are routine. Watch business news on television, where talking heads are often introduced with a reference to one of their dramatic forecasting successes. Pedro Ziff called the crash of 2008. The point is to make them credible, so we'll want to hear their next forecast. But even if we assume these statements are true accounts of what the person forecast, they often are not, they tell us next to nothing about the guest's accuracy, as viewers would know if they applied a little System 2 thought. Even a dart-throwing chimp will hit the occasional bullseye if he throws enough darts, and anyone can easily predict the next stock market crash by incessantly warning that the stock market is about to crash. And yet many people take these hollow claims seriously. A variant of this fallacy is to single out an extraordinarily successful person, show that it was extremely unlikely that the person could do what he or she did, and conclude that luck could not be the explanation. This often happens in news coverage of Wall Street. Someone beats the market 6 or 7 years in a row, journalists profile the great investor, calculate how unlikely it is to get such results by luck alone, and triumphantly announce that it's proof of skill. The mistake? They ignore how many other people were trying to do what the great man did. If it's many thousands, the odds of someone getting that lucky shoot up. Think of a lottery winner. It is fantastically unlikely that one particular ticket will win a major lottery, often one in many millions. But we don't conclude that lottery winners are highly skilled ticket pickers, because we know there are millions of tickets sold, which makes it highly likely that someone, somewhere, will win. A similar mistake can be found by rummaging through remaindered business books. A corporation or executive is on a roll, going from success to success, piling up money and fawning profiles in magazines. What comes next? Inevitably, it's a book recounting the successes and assuring readers that they can reap similar successes simply by doing whatever the corporation or executive did. These stories may be true, or fairy tales. It's impossible to know. These books seldom provide solid evidence that the highlighted qualities or actions caused happy outcomes, much less that someone who replicates them will get similarly happy outcomes. And they rarely acknowledge that factors beyond the hero's control, luck, may have played a role in the happy outcomes. Lest I add to this unfortunate genre, I should say unequivocally that the evidence presented so far does not establish that the super forecasters are super, much less that if readers retire to Santa Barbara and drive a little red convertible, they can forecast as accurately as Doug Lorch. So what should we make of Doug and the others? Are they super forecasters or super lucky? Don't answer yet. It is another of those pesky false dichotomies that buzz like mosquitoes around efforts to judge judgment. Most things in life involve skill and luck, in varying proportions. The mix may almost be all luck and a little skill, or almost all skill and a little luck. Or it could be one of a thousand other possible variations. That complexity makes it hard to figure out what to chalk up to skill and what to luck. A subject probed in depth by Michael Mobison, a global financial strategist, in his book, The Success Equation. But as Mobison noted, there is an elegant rule of thumb that applies to athletes and CEOs, stock analysts, and super forecasters. It involves regression to the mean. Some statistical concepts are both easy to understand and easy to forget. Regression to the mean is one of them. Let's say the average height of men is 5 feet 8 inches. Now imagine a man who is 6 feet tall, and then picture his adult son. Your initial System 1 hunch may be that the son is also 6 feet. That's possible, but unlikely. To see why, we have to engage in some strenuous System 2 reasoning. Imagine that we knew everyone's height and computed the correlation between the heights of fathers and sons. We would find a strong but imperfect relationship, a correlation of about 0.5, as captured by the line running through the data points in the chart below. It tells us that when the father is 6 feet, we should make a compromise prediction based on both the father's height and the population average. Our best guess for the son is 5 feet 10. The son's height has regressed toward the mean by 2 inches, halfway between the population average and the father's height. But as I said, regression to the mean is as easy to forget as it is to understand. Say you suffer from chronic back pain. Not all days are the same. Some days you feel fine. Others, you feel some pain, but not a lot, and occasionally it's awful. Of course, it's when you have one of those awful days that you are most likely to seek help by visiting a homeopath or some other dispenser of medical treatments unsupported by solid scientific evidence. The next day you wake up and you feel better. The treatment works. The placebo effect may have helped, but you probably would have felt better the next day even if you had received no treatment at all. Thanks to regression to the mean, a fact that won't occur to you unless you stop and think carefully, instead of going with the tip-of-your-nose conclusion. This modest little mistake is responsible for many of the things people believe but shouldn't. Keep regression to the mean in mind, however, and it becomes a valuable tool. Imagine that we had our 2,800 volunteers predict the outcome of 104 coin tosses a second time. The distribution would again look like a bell curve, with most people clustered around 50%, and tiny numbers correctly predicting almost none or almost all. But who gets the amazingly good results this time? Most likely it will be different people from last time. The correlation across rounds will be close to zero, and your best prediction for any given forecaster will be the average accuracy rate of 50%. In other words, total regression to the mean. To make the point unmistakable, imagine that we ask only those who got amazingly good results in the first round to do the exercise again. Thanks to regression to the mean, it's likely that most will do worse the second time. And the decline will be biggest for the luckiest. Those who got 90% right should expect a rapid descent to 50%. Of course, it's possible that a few people will again get 9 or 10 right, but the fact that everyone else is rapidly regressing to the mean should make us hesitate before we declare them coin toss gurus. Make them do the exercise again. Eventually, their luck will run out. So regression to the mean is an indispensable tool for testing the role of luck in performance. Slow reversion is consistent with activities dominated by skill, Mobison noted, while rapid reversion comes from luck being the dominant influence. To illustrate, imagine two people in the IARPA tournament, Frank and Nancy. In year one, Frank does horribly, but Nancy is outstanding. On the bell curve below, Frank is ranked in the bottom 1% and Nancy in the top 99%. If their results were caused entirely by luck, like coin flipping, then in year two, we would expect both Frank and Nancy to regress all the way back to 50%. If their results were equal parts luck and skill, we would expect halfway regression. Frank should rise to around 25%, between 1% and 50%, and Nancy fall to around 75%, between 50% and 99%. If their results were entirely decided by skill, there would be no regression. Frank would be just as awful in year two, and Nancy would be just as spectacular. So how did super forecasters hold up across years? That's the key question. And the answer is phenomenally well. For instance, in years two and three, we saw the opposite of regression to the mean. The super forecasters as a whole, including Doug Lorch, actually increased their lead over all other forecasters. but that result should make attentive readers suspicious. It suggests there was little or no luck behind the superforecaster's results. Given the nature of what they were predicting, and the irreducible uncertainty that lurks in some questions, I deeply doubt this possibility. Some questions were resolved by quirky last-minute events that no one, this side of God, could have foreseen. One such question asked whether there would be a fatal confrontation between vessels on the East China Sea. The answer turned out to be yes when, just before the closing date for the question, an angry Chinese fishing boat captain stabbed a South Korean Coast Guard officer who had seized his boat for a border violation. Other questions pivoted on complex interactions among systems of variables. Take the price of oil, long a graveyard topic for forecasting reputations. The number of factors that can drive the price up or down is huge, from frackers in the United States, to jihadists in Libya, to battery designers in Silicon Valley. And the number of factors that can influence those factors is even bigger. Many of these causal ties are also nonlinear, which, as Edward Lorenz showed, means even something as tiny as a butterfly's wing flaps can make a dramatic difference to what happens. So we have a mystery. If chance is playing a significant role, why aren't we observing significant regression of superforecasters as a whole toward the overall mean? An offsetting process must be pushing up superforecasters' performance numbers. And it's not hard to guess what that was. After year one, when the first cohort of superforecasters was identified, we congratulated them, anointed them super, and put them on teams with fellow superforecasters. Instead of regressing toward the mean, their scores got even better. This suggests that being recognized as super and placed on teams of intellectually stimulating colleagues improved their performance enough to erase the regression to the mean we would otherwise have seen. In years 3 and 4, we harvested fresh crops of superforecasters and put them to work in elite teams. That gave us more apples-to-apples comparisons. The new cohorts continued to do as well or better than they did in the previous year, again contrary to the regression hypothesis. But, as Wall Streeters well know, mortals can only defy the laws of statistical gravity for so long. The consistency and performance of superforecasters as a group should not mask the inevitable turnover among some top performers over time. The correlation between how well individuals do from one year to the next is about 0.65, modestly higher than that between the heights of fathers and sons. So we should still expect considerable regression toward the mean, and we observe just that. Each year, roughly 30% of the individual superforecasters fall from the ranks of the top 2% next year. But that also implies a good deal of consistency over time. 70% of superforecasters remain superforecasters. The chances of such consistency arising among coin flip guessers, where the year-to-year correlation is zero, is less than 1 in 100 million. But the chances of such consistency arising among forecasters, where year-to-year correlation is 0.65, is far higher, about 1 in 3. All of this suggests two key conclusions. One, we should not treat the superstars of any given year as infallible, not even Doug Lorch. Luck plays a role, and it is only to be expected that the superstars will occasionally have a bad year and produce ordinary results, just as superstar athletes occasionally look less than stellar. But more basically, and more hopefully, we can conclude that the superforecasters were not just lucky. Mostly their results reflected skill. Which raises the big question, why are superforecasters so good? Chapter 5. Super Smart? In 2008, Sanford Sandy Silman was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. It wasn't life-threatening, but it was debilitating. It made him weak and easily exhausted. He had back and hip pain. Walking was difficult. Even typing became a struggle. By 2011, he recalled, I could see the writing on the wall. He would soon have to give up his job as an atmospheric scientist. Sandy was 57. He knew that the loss of his work would leave a void in his life, and he would need something to keep him busy at a pace he could manage. So when he read about a forecasting tournament recruiting volunteers, he signed up and started making forecasts for the Good Judgment Project. When people stop working, they feel a bit lost and a bit worthless, he told me in an email he dictated using software that translates voice to text. I thought GJP might be good as a transition project for me. Not so much pressure or importance as work, but still something that counted, and also keeping my mind alive. And what a mind it is. Sandy has a Bachelor of Arts degree with a double major in math and physics from Brown University, plus a Master of Science degree from MIT's Technology and Policy Program, along with a second master's degree in applied mathematics from Harvard, and a PhD in applied physics from Harvard. After earning his doctorate, he became an atmospheric research scientist at the University of Michigan, where his work, published under such daunting titles as Effects of Additional Non-Methane Volatile Organic Compounds, Organic Nitrates, and Direct Emissions of Oxygenated Organic Species on Global Tropospheric Chemistry, won him awards and honors. And his intelligence isn't confined to math and science. He's a voracious reader, and not only in English. He's fluent in French, thanks to school and time as a visiting scholar in Switzerland. He added Russian to his repertoire because his wife is Russian, and he can speak and read Italian because I actually decided when I was 12 that I wanted to learn Italian and started just doing it on my own. He also speaks Spanish, but Sandy thinks that's so close to Italian it shouldn't count as another language. Unfortunately, Sandy's forecast for his health proved accurate. In 2012, he went on disability leave, although as he wrote in a typically gentle and gracious note to colleagues at the University of Michigan, I prefer to view it as the equivalent of early retirement. More happily, a remarkable number of Sandy's other forecasts proved accurate as well. In year one of the tournament, after being randomly assigned to a control condition that had him forecasting by himself, Sandy finished with a Breyer score of 0.19. That put him in tie for overall champion, beating out roughly 2,800 others, most of whom worked in more stimulating conditions. Sandy was thrilled. It's a bit non-professional to say so, but of course it is very exciting. You feel great. You tingle a bit. The only thing like it was when I was in high school and placed first in a math competition. I suppose I am still a high schooler at heart. When we put together our first list of super forecasters, Sandy's name was at the top. It's hard not to suspect that Sandy's remarkable mind explains his remarkable results, and that the same is true of the other super forecasters. 2 years into the research, we hosted a gathering of super forecasters in the conference room atop Huntsman Hall at the Wharton School, and it was obvious from the chatter alone that these were very sharp people who followed the news closely, particularly the elite media. They love books, too. When I asked Joshua Frankel what he reads for fun, the young Brooklyn filmmaker rattled off the names of highbrow authors like Thomas Pynchon, thought for a moment, and added that he'd recently read a biography of the German rocket scientist, Wernher von Braun, and various histories of New York, although Frankel was careful to note that the books about New York are also for his work. He is producing an opera about the legendary clash between Robert Moses, New York's great urban planner, and the free-spirited anti-planner Jane Jacobs. Frankel is not someone to tangle with on Jeopardy. Are super forecasters simply better because they are more knowledgeable and intelligent than others? That would be flattering for them, but deflating for the rest of us. Knowledge is something we can all increase, but only slowly. People who haven't stayed mentally active have little hope of catching up to lifelong learners. Intelligence feels like an even more daunting obstacle. There are believers in cognitive enhancement pills and computer puzzles who may someday be vindicated, but most people feel that adult intelligence is relatively fixed, a function of how well you did in the DNA lottery at conception and the lottery for loving, wealthy families at birth. If super forecasting is a job for 3-standard-deviation Mensa-certified geniuses, the top 1%, then the vast majority of us can never qualify. So why bother trying? The idea that knowledge and intelligence drive foresight is plausible, but as Archie Cochrane showed so well, plausibility is not enough. we must put the hypothesis to the test. Thanks to project co-leader Barbara Mellers and the volunteers who endured a grueling battery of psychological tests before they started forecasting, we had the data to do that. To gauge fluid intelligence, or raw crunching power, volunteers had to figure out puzzles, like the one on page 108, where the goal is to fill in the missing space at the lower right. Solving it requires identifying the rules generating patterns in the row. Each row must have a distinctive symbol in the center of its figures. And each column must contain all three shapes. The correct answer is the second figure in the second row. High-powered pattern recognition skills won't get you far, though, if you don't know where to look for patterns in the real world. So we measured crystallized intelligence, knowledge, using some U.S.-centric questions like, how many justices sit on the Supreme Court? And more global questions like, which nations are permanent members of the UN Security Council? Before we get to the results, bear in mind that several thousand people volunteered for the GJP in the first year, and the 2,800 who were motivated enough to work through all the testing and make forecasts were far from a randomly selected sample. That matters. Random selection ensures a sample is representative of the population from which it's drawn. Lacking that, we can't assume our volunteers reflected the population at large, in the United States or anywhere. After all, our 2,800 volunteers were people who had read about the forecasting tournament on a blog or in an article and thought to themselves, yes, I'd like to spend a good-sized chunk of my precious free time analyzing Nigerian politics, Greek bonds, Chinese military expenditures, Russian oil and gas production, and other complex geopolitical matters. I'd like to do that for the better part of a year. And I'd like to do it for no material gain other than a $250 gift certificate. We can be quite confident these are not average people. So to understand the role of intelligence and knowledge in super forecaster success, we have to go a step further. We must compare the super forecaster's intelligence and knowledge not only with that of other forecasters, but with that of the general population of the United States. What did we find? Regular forecasters scored higher on intelligence and knowledge tests than about 70% of the population. Super forecasters did better, placing higher than about 80% of the population. Note three things. First, the big jumps in intelligence and knowledge are from the public to the forecasters, not from forecasters to super forecasters. Second, although super forecasters are well above average, they did not score off the charts high, and most fall well short of so-called genius territory, a problematic concept often arbitrarily defined as the top 1%, or an IQ of 135 and up. So it seems intelligence and knowledge help, but they add little beyond a certain threshold. So super forecasting does not require a Harvard PhD and the ability to speak five languages. I find that conclusion satisfying, because it squares nicely with the hunch Daniel Kahneman shared with me all those years ago, when I started this research, that high-powered subject matter experts would not be much better forecasters than attentive readers of the New York Times. It should also satisfy the reader. If you've made it this far, you've probably got the right stuff. But having the requisite intelligence and knowledge is not enough. Many clever and informed forecasters in the tournament fell far short of super forecaster accuracy. And history is replete with brilliant people who made forecasts that proved considerably less than prescient. Robert McNamara, defense secretary under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, was famously dubbed one of the best and the brightest. But he and his colleagues escalated the war in Vietnam in the firm belief that if South Vietnam were lost to the communists, all of Southeast Asia would follow, and American security would be imperiled. Their certainty wasn't based on any serious analysis. In fact, no serious analysis of this critical forecast was conducted until 1967, years after the decisions to escalate had been made. The foundations of our decision-making were gravely flawed, McNamara wrote in his autobiography. We failed to analyze our assumptions critically, then or later. Ultimately, it's not the crunching power that counts. It's how you use it. Fermi eyes. Here's a question that definitely was not asked in the forecasting tournament. How many piano tuners are there in Chicago? Don't even think about letting Google find the answer for you. The Italian-American physicist Enrico Fermi, a central figure in the invention of the atomic bomb, concocted this little brain teaser decades before the invention of the internet. And Fermi's students did not have the Chicago Yellow Pages at hand. They had nothing. And yet Fermi expected them to come up with a reasonably accurate estimate. Outside Fermi's classroom, most people would frown, roll their eyes, scratch an ear and sigh. Well, maybe. Long pause. And they would offer a number. How did they arrive at that number? Ask them, and they would shrug and say nothing more informative than, it seems about right. The number came out of a black box. They had no idea how it was generated. Fermi knew people could do much better, and the key was to break down the question with more questions like, what would have to be true for this to happen? Here, we can break the question down by asking, what information would allow me to answer the question? So what would we need to know to calculate the number of piano tuners in Chicago? Well, the number of piano tuners depends on how much piano tuning work there is, and how much work it takes to employ one piano tuner. So I could nail this question if I knew four facts. One, the number of pianos in Chicago. Two, how often pianos are tuned each year. Three, how long it takes to tune a piano. Four, how many hours a year the average piano tuner works. With the first three facts, I can figure out the total amount of piano tuning work in Chicago. Then I can divide it by the last and, just like that, I'll have a pretty good sense of how many piano tuners there are in Chicago. But I don't have any of that information. So you may think I've wasted my time by exchanging one question I can't answer for four. Not so. What Fermi understood is that by breaking down the question, we can better separate the knowable and the unknowable. So guessing, pulling a number out of the black box, isn't eliminated. But we have brought our guessing process out into the light of day, where we can inspect it. And the net result tends to be a more accurate estimate than whatever number happened to pop out of the black box when we first read the question. Of course, all this means we have to overcome our deep-rooted fear of looking dumb. Fermiizing dares us to be wrong. In that spirit, I'll take my best shot at each of the four items. 1. How many pianos are there in Chicago? I have no idea. But just as I broke down the first question, I can break this down by asking what I would need to know in order to answer it. A. How many people are there in Chicago? I'm not sure. But I do know Chicago is the third largest American city after New York and Los Angeles. And I think L.A. has 4 million people or so. That's helpful. To narrow this down, Fermi would advise setting a confidence interval. A range that you are 90% sure contains the right answer. So I'm pretty sure Chicago has more than, say, 1.5 million people. And I'm pretty sure it has fewer than 3.5 million people. But where is the correct answer within that range? I'm not sure. So I'll take the midpoint and guess that Chicago has 2.5 million people. B. What percentage of people own a piano? Pianos are too expensive for most families, and most who can't afford one don't really want one. So I'll put it at 1 in 100. That's mostly a black box guess, but it's the best I can do. C. How many institutions, schools, concert halls, bars, own pianos? Again, I don't know. But many would, and some, like music schools, would own many pianos. I'll again make a black box guess, and say that it's enough to double the per-person number of pianos, to roughly 2 in 100. D. With those guesses, I can do some simple math and conclude that there are 50,000 pianos in Chicago. 2. How often are pianos tuned? Maybe once a year. That strikes me as reasonable. Why? I don't know. It's another black box guess. 3. How long does it take to tune a piano? I'll say 2 hours. Again, it's a black box guess. 4. How many hours a year does the average piano tuner work? This one I can break down. A. The standard American work week is 40 hours, minus 2 weeks of vacation. I don't see any reason why piano tuners would be different. So I'll multiply 40 hours by 50 weeks to come up with 2,000 hours a year. B. But piano tuners have to spend some of that time traveling between pianos. So I should reduce my total by that much. How much time do they spend between jobs? I'll guess 20% of their work hours. So I conclude that the average piano tuner works 1,600 hours a year. Now I'll assemble my guesses to make a final calculation. If 50,000 pianos need tuning once a year, and it takes 2 hours to tune one piano, that's 100,000 total piano tuning hours. Divide that by the annual number of hours worked by one piano tuner, and you get 62.5 piano tuners in Chicago. So I will estimate that there are 63 piano tuners in Chicago. How close am I? Many people have taken a crack at Fermi's classic puzzler over the years, including the psychologist Daniel Levitin, whose presentation I've adapted here. Levitin found 83 listings for piano tuners in the Chicago Yellow Pages, but many were duplicates, such as businesses with more than one phone number. So the precise number isn't certain. But my estimate, which rests on a lot of crude guesswork, looks surprisingly close to the mark. Fermi was renowned for his estimates. With little or no information at his disposal, he could often do back-of-the-envelope calculations like this to come up with a number that subsequent measurement revealed to be impressively accurate. In many physics and engineering faculties, Fermi estimates, or Fermi problems, strange tests like estimate the number of square inches of pizza consumed by all the students at the University of Maryland during one semester, are part of the curriculum. I shared Levitin's discussion of Fermi estimation with a group of super forecasters, and it drew a chorus of approval. Sandy Silman told me Fermi estimation was so critical to his job as a scientist working with atmospheric models that it became a part of my natural way of thinking. That's a huge advantage for a forecaster, as we shall see. A murder mystery. On October 12, 2004, Yasser Arafat, the 75-year-old leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, became severely ill with vomiting and abdominal pain. Over the next 3 weeks, his condition worsened. On October 29th, he was flown to a hospital in France. He fell into a coma. Decades earlier, before adopting the role of statesman, Arafat had directed bombings and shootings and survived many Israeli attempts on his life. But on November 11, 2004, the man who was once a seemingly indestructible enemy of Israel was pronounced dead. What killed him was uncertain. But even before he died, there was speculation that he had been poisoned. In July 2012, researchers at Switzerland's Lausanne University Institute of Radiation Physics announced that they had tested some of Arafat's belongings and discovered unnaturally high levels of polonium-210. That was ominous. Polonium-210 is a radioactive element that can be deadly if ingested. In 2006, Alexander Litvinenko, a former Russian spy living in London and a prominent critic of Vladimir Putin, was murdered with polonium-210. That August, Arafat's widow gave permission for his body to be exhumed and tested by two separate agencies, in Switzerland and France. So IARPA asked tournament forecasters the following question. Will either the French or Swiss inquiries find elevated levels of polonium in the remains of Yasser Arafat's body? On its face, this was a tough question. A CSI Jerusalem murder mystery. With all the Byzantine complexities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the background, how would the average person tackle it? They would probably start with a hunch that came to them the moment they read the question. The strength of the hunch would depend on the person. Someone who knew only a little about Arafat and the long Israeli-Palestinian conflict might only experience a whisper. But for someone who is well-informed and passionate about politics in that volatile region, it would be more like a shout. Israel would never do that, they might feel. Or, of course Israel did it. That hunch is the tip of your nose perspective. It sprang out of a black box. How exactly it was generated by the person who experiences it, I cannot say. But turning it into a forecast is easy. How strongly do you feel? If the hunch is, Israel would never do that, make your forecast 5% or 0. If it's, of course Israel did it, forecast 95% or 100% and you're done. If you're more ambivalent, choose something closer to 50%. When TV pundits make quick volleys of forecasts, this is pretty much all they do. That's no way to make accurate forecasts. If the tip of your nose perspective contains any error, you won't catch it. Just as you won't catch it if you blurt out 10 cents on the cognitive reflection test. And there is a mistake here. Did you catch it? Read the question again. Will either the French or Swiss inquiries find elevated levels of polonium in the remains of Yasser Arafat's body? Neither Israel would never do that, nor, of course Israel did it, is actually responsive to that question. They answer a different question. Did Israel poison Yasser Arafat? System 1 pulled a classic bait and switch. The hard question that was actually asked was replaced by the easy question that wasn't. That trap could have been avoided. The key is to Fermiize. Bill Flack lives in Kearney, Nebraska, smack in the middle of the Midwest and a planet away from the Middle East. He has no experience in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to say the least. But he didn't need any to get off to a great start on this question. Thinking like Fermi, Bill unpacked the question by asking himself, what would it take for the answer to be yes? What would it take for it to be no? He realized that the first step of his analysis had nothing to do with politics. Polonium decays quickly. For the answer to be yes, scientists would have to be able to detect polonium on the remains of a man dead for years. Could they? A teammate had posted a link to the Swiss team's report on the testing of Arafat's possessions. So Bill read it, familiarized himself with the science of polonium testing, and was satisfied that they could do it. Only then did he move on to the next stage of the analysis. Again, Bill asked himself how Arafat's remains could have been contaminated with enough polonium to trigger a positive result. Obviously, Israel poisoned Arafat was one way. But because Bill carefully broke the question down, he realized there were others. Arafat had many Palestinian enemies. They could have poisoned him. It was also possible that there had been intentional post-mortem contamination by some Palestinian faction, looking to give the appearance that Israel had done a Litvinenko on Arafat, Bill told me later. These alternatives mattered because each additional way Arafat's body could have been contaminated with polonium increased the probability that it was. Bill also noted that only one of the two European teams had to get a positive result for the correct answer to the question to be yes, another factor that nudged the needle in that direction. This was only the beginning, but thanks to Bill's Fermi-style analysis, he had already avoided the bait-and-switch tiger trap and laid out a roadmap for subsequent analysis. He was off to a terrific start. Outside first. So what's the next step? Most people who knew better than to draw a conclusion based on their gut feeling about Israel's culpability would think now is the time to roll up their sleeves and dig into the complex politics surrounding Arafat at the time of his death. But it's too soon for that. To illustrate why, I'm going to ask you a question about the Renzetti family. The Renzettis live in a small house at 84 Chestnut Avenue. Frank Renzetti is 44 and works as a bookkeeper for a moving company. Mary Renzetti is 35 and works part-time at a daycare. They have one child, Tommy, who is 5. Frank's widowed mother, Camila, also lives with a family. My question, how likely is it that the Renzettis have a pet? To answer that, most people would zero in on the family's details. Renzetti is an Italian name, someone might think. So are Frank and Camila. That may mean Frank grew up with lots of brothers and sisters, but he's only got one child. He probably wants to have a big family, but he can't afford it. So it would make sense that he compensated a little by getting a pet. Someone else might think, people get pets for kids, and the Renzettis only have one child, and Tommy isn't old enough to take care of a pet. So it seems unlikely. This sort of storytelling can be very compelling, particularly when the available details are much richer than what I've provided here. But super forecasters wouldn't bother with any of that, at least not at first. The first thing they would do is find out what percentage of American households own a pet. Statisticians call that the base rate, how common something is within a broader class. Daniel Kahneman has a much more evocative visual term for it. He calls it the outside view, in contrast to the inside view, which is the specifics of the particular case. A few minutes with Google tells me about 62% of American households own pets. That's the outside view here. Starting with the outside view means I will start by estimating that there is a 62% chance the Renzettis have a pet. Then I will turn to the inside view, all those details about the Renzettis, and use them to adjust that initial 62% up or down. It's natural to be drawn to the inside view. It's usually concrete and filled with engaging detail we can use to craft a story about what's going on. The outside view is typically abstract, bare, and doesn't lend itself so readily to storytelling. So even smart, accomplished people routinely fail to consider the outside view. The Wall Street Journal columnist and former Reagan speechwriter, Peggy Noonan, once predicted trouble for the Democrats because polls had found that George W. Bush's approval rating, which had been rock bottom at the end of his term, had rebounded to 47% 4 years after leaving office, equal to President Obama's. Noonan found that astonishing and deeply meaningful. But if she had considered the outside view, she would have discovered that presidential approval always rises after a president leaves office. Even Richard Nixon's number went up. So Bush's improved standing wasn't surprising in the least, which strongly suggests the meaning she drew from it was illusory. Super forecasters don't make that mistake. If Bill Flack were asked whether, in the next 12 months, there would be an armed clash between China and Vietnam over some border dispute, he wouldn't immediately delve into the particulars of that border dispute and the current state of China-Vietnam relations. He would instead look at how often there have been armed clashes in the past. Say we get hostile conduct between China and Vietnam every 5 years, Bill says. I'll use a 5-year recurrence model to predict the future. In any given year, then, the outside view would suggest to Bill there is a 20% chance of a clash. Having established that, Bill would look at the situation today and adjust that number up or down. It's often possible to find different outside views. In the Renzetti problem, the pet ownership rate of American households is one outside view. But it can be refined. Single-family detached homes like 84 Chestnut Avenue are more pet-friendly living environments than apartment buildings or condos. So we could narrow the lens and use the pet ownership rate of American single-family detached homes, let's say it's 73%, as our outside view. That second outside view more closely matches the particular case we're interested in. So 73% would probably be a better bet as our starting point. Of course, I've made this easy for myself by offering examples where the outside view is obvious. But what is the outside view in the Arafat polonium question? That's tough. It's not as if dead Middle Eastern leaders are routinely exhumed to investigate suspicions of poisoning. So there's no way we're going to be able to do a quick Google search and find that poison is detected in 73% of cases like this. But that doesn't mean we should skip the outside view and go straight to the inside. Let's think about this Fermi style. Here we have a famous person who is dead. Major investigative bodies think there is enough reason for suspicion that they are exhuming the body. Under those circumstances, how often would the investigation turn up evidence of poisoning? I don't know, and there is no way to find out. But I do know there is at least a prima facie case that persuades courts and medical investigators that this is worth looking into. It has to be considerably above zero. So let's say it's at least 20%. But the probability can't be 100%, because if it were that clear and certain, the evidence would have been uncovered before burial. So let's say the probability cannot be higher than 80%. That's a big range. The midpoint is 50%, so that outside view can serve as our starting point. You may wonder why the outside view should come first. After all, you could dive into the inside view and draw conclusions, then turn to the outside view. Wouldn't that work as well? Unfortunately, no, it probably wouldn't. The reason is a basic psychological concept called anchoring. When we make estimates, we tend to start with some number and adjust. The number we start with is called the anchor. It's important because we typically underadjust, which means a bad anchor can easily produce a bad estimate. And it's astonishingly easy to settle on a bad anchor. In classic experiments, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky showed you could influence people's judgment merely by exposing them to a number. Any number, even one that is obviously meaningless, like one randomly selected by the spin of a wheel. So a forecaster who starts by diving into the inside view risks being swayed by a number that may have little or no meaning. But if she starts with the outside view, her analysis will begin with an anchor that is meaningful. And a better anchor is a distinct advantage. The inside view. You've Fermiized the question, consulted the outside view, and now, finally, you can delve into the inside view. In the case of the Arafat polonium question, that means digging into Middle Eastern politics and history. And there's a lot of that. So you fill a small library with books and settle in for 6 months of reading, right? Wrong. Such diligence would be admirable, but it would also be misguided. If you aimlessly examine one tree, then another and another, you will quickly become lost in the forest. A good exploration of the inside view does not involve wandering around, soaking up any and all information, and hoping that insight somehow emerges. It is targeted and purposeful. It is an investigation, not an amble. Again, Fermiization is the key. When Bill Flack Fermiized the Arafat polonium question, he realized there were several pathways to a yes answer. Israel could have poisoned Arafat, Arafat's Palestinian enemies could have poisoned him, or Arafat's remains could have been contaminated after his death to make it look like a poisoning. Hypotheses like these are the ideal framework for investigating the inside view. Start with the first hypothesis. Israel poisoned Yasser Arafat with polonium. What would it take for that to be true? 1. Israel had or could obtain polonium. 2. Israel wanted Arafat dead badly enough to take a big risk. 3. Israel had the ability to poison Arafat with polonium. Each of these elements could then be researched, looking for evidence pro and con, to get a sense of how likely they are to be true, and therefore how likely the hypothesis is to be true. Then it's on to the next hypothesis, and the next. This sounds like detective work, because it is. Or to be precise, it is detective work as real investigators do it, not the detectives on TV shows. It's methodical, slow, and demanding. But it works far better than wandering aimlessly in a forest of information. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So you have an outside view and an inside view. Now they have to be merged, just as your brain merges the different perspectives of your two eyeballs into a single vision. David Rogg, a super forecaster and semi-retired software engineer living in Virginia, did that when he tackled the question about terrorism in Europe. It was early 2015, shortly after terrorists had murdered 11 people at the Paris satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. IARPA asked, will there be an attack carried out by Islamic militants in France, the UK, Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Spain, Portugal, or Italy between 21st January and 31st March 2015? At a moment when the media was awash with information about Islamist terrorism and Muslim communities in Europe, it was tempting to rush to the inside view. David knew better. First, he found a list of Islamist terror attacks on Wikipedia. Then he counted the number of attacks in the specified countries over the previous 5 years. There were 6. So I calculate the base rate as 1.2 per year, he wrote in the GJP forum. Having established the outside view, David switched to the inside view. In the previous several years, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, movement had surged to prominence. Hundreds of European Muslims had enlisted, and ISIS had repeatedly threatened Europe with terror attacks. David decided that this changed the situation so significantly that the data from 2010 and earlier years were no longer relevant. So he dropped 2010 from his calculation. That raised the base rate to 1.5, which I suspect is still low, given the level of ISIS recruitment and threats. But David also noted that security measures had been sharply increased after the Charlie Hebdo attack, which would decrease the likelihood of attack. Balancing these two factors, David decided, I'll only raise it by, say, 1/5 to 1.8 attacks per year. There were 69 days left in the forecast period, so David divided 69 by 365. Then he multiplied by 1.8. Result? 0.34. So he concluded that there is a 34% chance the answer to IARPA's question would be yes. It was a textbook merger of outside and inside views. But David wasn't saying 34%, final answer, like a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Remember, he shared his analysis on a GJP forum. Why? Because he wanted to know what his teammates were thinking. In other words, he was looking for more perspectives. Coming up with an outside view, an inside view, and a synthesis of the two isn't the end. It's a good beginning. Super forecasters constantly look for other views they can synthesize into their own. There are many different ways to obtain new perspectives. What do other forecasters think? What outside and inside views have they come up with? What are experts saying? You can even train yourself to generate different perspectives. When Bill Flack makes a judgment, he often explains his thinking to his teammates, as David Rogg did, and he asks them to critique it. In part, he does that because he hopes they'll spot flaws and offer their own perspectives. But writing his judgment down is also a way of distancing himself from it, so he can step back and scrutinize it. It's an auto-feedback thing, he says. Do I agree with this? Are there holes in this? Should I be looking for something else to fill this in? Would I be convinced by this if I were somebody else? That is a very smart move. Researchers have found that merely asking people to assume their initial judgment is wrong, to seriously consider why that might be, and then make another judgment, produces a second estimate which, when combined with the first, improves accuracy almost as much as getting a second estimate from another person. The same effect was produced simply by letting several weeks pass before asking people to make a second estimate. This approach, built on the wisdom of the crowd concept, has been called the crowd within. The billionaire financier George Soros exemplifies it. A key part of his success, he has often said, is his mental habit of stepping back from himself so he can judge his own thinking and offer a different perspective to himself. There is an even simpler way of getting another perspective on a question. Tweak its wording. Imagine a question like, will the South African government grant the Dalai Lama a visa within 6 months? The naive forecaster will go looking for evidence that suggests the Dalai Lama will get his visa, while neglecting to look for evidence that suggests he won't. The more sophisticated forecaster knows about confirmation bias, and will seek out evidence that cuts both ways. But if you are constantly thinking the question is, will he get his visa? Your mental playing field is tilted in one direction, and you may unwittingly slide into confirmation bias. This is South Africa. Black government officials suffered under apartheid. Of course they will give a visa to Tibet's own Nelson Mandela. To check that tendency, turn the question on its head and ask, will the South African government deny the Dalai Lama for 6 months? That tiny wording change encourages you to lean in the opposite direction and look for reasons why it would deny the visa. A desire not to anger its biggest trading partner being a rather big one. Dragonfly forecasting. Outside views, inside view, other outside and inside views, second opinions from yourself. That's a lot of perspectives, and inevitably a lot of dissonant information. David Rogg's neat synthesis of contrary outside and inside views made it look easy, but it's not. and the difficulty only mounts as the number of perspectives being synthesized increases. The commentary that superforecasters post on GJP forums is rife with, on the one hand, / on the other, dialectical banter.